The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member at TNTRadio.live. Patrick Henningsen talks on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Good afternoon, everybody in England and Europe. Good morning to you in the United States. And an extra early good morning to you in the Antipodes, as you may be able to tell. I'm not Patrick Henningsen. I'm Basil Valentine sitting in for Patrick Henningsen this afternoon while he's on the road. But we hope to connect him at the top of the hour or very soon thereafter. I will soon be joined by my colleague Christian James, and we look forward to talking to him. But first, of course, as our co-commentator yesterday, Piers Robinson, so eloquently put it, we have the rolling thunder of the news cycle to deal with, a seemingly endless supply of challenging, if not alarming, news stories. We've got to go back to Ukraine, really, for the first item on the agenda. Biden, of course, announcing that the Abrams tanks, notoriously difficult to maintain, as we heard in the news there, and apparently extremely thirsty for gasoline, nevertheless are on their way to the arch grifter Zelensky, who, quite frankly, reminds me of a character from the Charles Dickens novel Oliver, Always on the Make. In March, Biden said, the idea that we're going, that's last March, of course, the idea that we're going to send in offensive equipment and have planes and tanks and trains going in would be World War III. Well, it seems Biden is now quite happy to supply those tanks and initiate what is arguably World War III in all but name, even if it is currently confined to a small part of eastern Ukraine. Nevertheless, more and more countries are becoming involved, even if the conflict itself remains and hopefully will remain localized. Someone called David North has pointed out on Twitter that Germany's decision to deploy its Leopard tanks against Russia coincides with the 90th anniversary of Hitler's accession to power on January the 30th, 1933, and the 80th anniversary, exactly 10 years later, of the surrender of General Paulus at Stalingrad on February the 2nd, 1943, where apparently Field Marshal Paulus was found sitting vacuously with his staff in a bunker filled with the stench of human waste. Hitler ordered Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, the rousing Ode to Joy, he ordered it to be played on the radio after the surrender. It is, of course, an extremely serious escalation. We seem to get only serious escalations, and it seems that the likes of the commentariat are going to cheerleader for these, extremely foolhardy, in my view, developments. Don't be fooled, writes Jan Philip Hein in The Guardian. Germany's U-turn on sending tanks to Ukraine is a reluctant one. The invasion of Ukraine has shaken Germany out of its decades-long commitment to pacifism, he writes. If the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz chose to upgrade Germany's military assistance to Ukraine this week, it was only as a result of the extreme amount of pressure that has been building up in recent days, mostly, of course, from the United States, but also from, I'm ashamed to say, probably the United Kingdom via back channels. That's if the Germans pay any attention to us. He goes on, Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine has thrust upon Germany the necessity of some serious self-analysis. It has shattered many certainties, including even that most ironclad belief of post-war German history, which maintained that no conflict could ever be resolved militarily. Germany's famous creed, Wandel durch Handel, change through trade, was directly derived from this thinking, which had permeated virtually every part of its society. And rightly so, might I add. Keep this in mind when remembering that Germany maintained its lonely support for the highly controversial Nord Stream 2 pipeline project until days before the Russian invasion. We still don't know, of course, who was responsible for sabotaging it, except that it was highly unlikely to be either the Germans or the Russians, since they were all in favour, it being a joint project between the two of them. Interesting, isn't it, how that incident has been completely memory-holed in recent weeks. So, you know, the drums of war beat ever louder, as we said yesterday on the programme. Mature, sane, wise voices calling for immediate ceasefire and subsequent peace negotiations seem to be very thin on the ground. We're always hearing about how powerful and influential Henry Kissinger is. Well, bizarrely, he has been one of few global voices, along, of course, with Donald Trump, who have been calling for negotiations, as have the Turks, who, interestingly enough, not entirely uncoincidentally, it has been suggested, may seek to secede from NATO at some point in the next 6 months. And one wonders too, of course, whether the rigging of the 2020 election to ensure the defeat of Donald Trump was because this war with Russia had long since been planned and he represented a not inconsiderable obstacle. Having said himself publicly that had he been in charge, there would be no war. We can only hope that sanity prevails. Hope and pray, if you believe in God, that sanity prevails and that this does not turn out to become the Armageddon that some of us fear it might. Meanwhile, changing tack only slightly to Washington and the bizarre revelation that not only former President Trump, but sitting President Joe Biden and former Vice President Mike Pence have all been in possession of classified documents. As Tucker Carlson pointed out this week, the United States government has managed to classify a billion documents. I mean, a truly breathtaking number. I mean, I didn't think there were a billion documents in the world. But that's what they've done. And some of these have found their way into the hands of Joe. Of course, it would appear, as Tucker pointed out, that some of them have found their way into the hands of his wayward son, Hunter. And indeed, that Hunter may have used information contained therein to his advantage, which would be a criminal act. But given the way the deep state concerted its effort to get Biden into power, lever him into power with, you know, minimal popular support. I mean, I think he probably got about 43 or 44% of the vote, if that. One can only think that the deep state have decided they've had enough of the senile old fool and want him gone, replaced by a stronger candidate for 2024. I mean, he'll be in his 80s should he decide to run again in 2024. He originally said, people may have forgotten, back at the end of the Obama presidency, 2014, 15, 16, that he wasn't going to run, only to be persuaded to do so. Was his elevation to the top job a reward for whipping in Democratic congressmen and senators for the Iraq war, for which he cheer-led, of course, a further demonstration of the absolute rank hypocrisy of the Western imperial powers with regards to all this nonsense about the international rules-based order. But I digress. The suggestion is that the classified documents panic, whether it's Biden, Pence or Trump, is a show of power by the permanent bureaucracy of Washington over elected officials, asserting the authority of the deep state, which is, of course, an inversion of how the executive branch is supposed to work. Something pointed out again by Tucker in a terrific segment about the downfall of Richard Nixon. But of course, at the moment, the partisanship, which is, I think, sort of more accentuated in Washington now than at any time in recent history, is blinding people to this fact. So, of course, Republicans are all absolutely delighted that Biden's under pressure, and you know, likewise, Democrats think that Trump is treasonous, and in fact, the real criminals most probably lie elsewhere. You're listening to TNT Radio. This is me, Basil Valentine, sitting in for Patrick Henningsen. We're going to take a short break now, and when we come back, we're going to connect with a researcher at 21st Century Wire, Christian James, who has got all his stories lined up for us. I'm Basil Valentine, and we'll see you very shortly.
TNT Radio's Mike Ryan.
A Qantas flight to Sydney has returned to Fiji as a precaution after pilots received a report of fumes in the cabin. Now, that's days after a service from Auckland issued a mayday following an engine shutdown. Forget the exhaust. Where's the engine? Oh, there it is, plummeting to earth. The Qantas has now had its sixth incident. It's just over a week after another plane was forced to turn back following issues surrounding paperwork.
Yeah, where are we going? I don't know. Where's our map?
I mean, what's wrong with Qantas? I mean, Qantas, the Australian airline, is no more. Now, Alan Joyce, who continues to get enormous chunks of money every year because he's doing such a wonderful, wonderful job. Now, if I ran a business like that, some say maybe I do, but if I ran a business like that and all my planes are turning around because they weren't looked after well enough, or they forgot the paperwork, first of all, the buck stops at the top, doesn't it? So why is Alan Joyce still there?
Mike Ryan on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Public school is the instituted agency of socialism throughout every community.
The U.S. government has no authority to have any role in education.
We're going to lose our very republic if we don't stop this indoctrination of children in government schools.
What happened to us in China can happen here.
Have one kind of education and then call it equity.
It's about outcomes. It's about trying to force us all to be equal.
I think we're going to have a race civil war in our hands.
We are exposing kids to pornography as early as kindergarten. Parents just don't know.
No, not anymore. Not anymore. Parents need to wake up. They don't have the interests of your child at heart.
Truth and Lies in American Education at SalemNow.com.
Patrick Henningsen and TNT.
Good afternoon, everyone in the UK. Good morning to listeners in the United States. I'm Basil Valentine. You're listening to TNT Today's News Talk. I'm sitting in for Patrick Henningsen this afternoon. I hope it's not too much of a disappointment for you. Joining me today on the line is our researcher over at Sunday Wire, 21st Century Wire, who I'm shamed, semi, to say, that I've never spoken to before, Christian James. Hello, Christian. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Basil. Great to talk to you. You're right. We've spoken in groups, but never together one-to-one.
Right, right. And certainly not for a long time.
No, certainly not. No, so I'm really looking forward to what we've got planned for the next hour or so, and hopefully we'll keep our listeners engaged with what we're going to be talking about. And I guess there's plenty to be on the table, as it were, as coming off the back
as
of
always,
Davos.
Yeah, I was just going to say, these are interesting time to be alive, isn't it? You know.
Yeah, you know, it certainly is. I mean, whether we take it as a positive or negative, today and in our world, it is possibly the most exciting amount of things happening to the human race, to people, to societies, perhaps ever. And I think we owe it to ourselves to actually be so switched on and engaged to find out what is going on, because so much is happening that perhaps we're not in control of, or things that perhaps we're not aware of.
Absolutely. Yeah, hear, okay. Christian. So what's top of your agenda this afternoon?
Well, I have to say, so I've been working on an article for 21st Century Wire in the background, as it were, mainly focused around our energy crisis and our energy concerns. So there's a couple of things I'd like to pull from that, and then I'd like to go into what that means. And I guess looking at what is happening over in Pakistan right now. So for those who don't know, in the UK, we've had a number of tests where we are currently, the national grid is paying users of energy and electricity particularly to turn off their electricity, and they get paid for it on a daily basis to soften the amount of energy being sapped by the system, as it were. Now, I did, if you go to the National Grid website, it's really informative in the sense that you can actually see in real time how much energy is being drawn per gigawatt from our energy reserves, such as coal, so from our gas, our nuclear, our biomass, our solar, and so on. You can kind of see that in real time on the National Grid website. It's really interesting the fact that on a daily basis, we do not generate enough in this country to cover that the energy requirement on a day-to-day basis. Our demand is outstripping our supply. We are currently having to pull from the continent, from the Netherlands, Belgium, France, and Spain, just to keep our current situation afloat. So because of this, the National Grid has gone, okay, we'll pay many of our users on our grid to turn their electricity off for a bit, to dampen the load. Interestingly enough, this is happening in a number of other countries as well. So we've seen this happen this past week in Pakistan. They actually closed their entire grid down, and then they were unable to reboot it. They were then out of power for more than 24 hours. The entire country was in complete darkness.
Wow.
I don't know if anyone caught that.
That wasn't widely reported in the UK, no.
No, it really wasn't. You go.
Well, I was just going to say, power outages in many parts of the developing world are not unusual. You know, lots of places only have electricity for a fixed number of hours every day, including war-torn countries like Syria, including Gaza and West Bank, I believe. So, you know, I wouldn't say we're lucky, but we've certainly taken 24/7 electricity for granted in this country ever since I've been alive. And with regards to pulling it from Spain, well, it is a bit warmer down there, Christian.
It certainly is. Maybe their solar farms are helping fund keeping our dreary weather at bay.
Yes. Yeah, and have you got any idea how one becomes one of these people paid to switch the lights off? Because I'll sign up.
To my understanding, actually, your energy company actually sent everyone a letter or an email asking them if they would donate to do so. I do believe, though, however, you have to have a smart meter.
Ah. I knew there'd be a catch.
I do believe that is the case, and I think that would mean that they have the ability to perhaps turn off your power externally. So
right.
from their centralized position, they can go, okay,
right.
That's what you said you want to do. You could take your power off for a bit, and we can reduce the drain on the system.
Right. Of course, one of the biggest issues with any power outage is, well, of course, obviously hospitals and people who require power for dialysis and other life-saving equipment. I always think of refrigeration, Christian, you know, and
certainly.
Food spoiling and, you know.
Yeah, it's like, can that live off-grid in people's homes? I'm not sure. Can the freezer hold its temperature for a period of time? To my understanding, I think it's for a period of time of demand from around 5 p.m. to around 9 p.m. I think right. Octopus Energy, OVO, a number of the kind of mid to large energy companies in the UK are doing this service. I saw an article come out of that was published on Sky.com a couple of days ago, and it was a kind of a generic article, but it was looking at the kind of price that they're offering people, and it was like £6 and £7 an hour. So, you know, it's nothing to be sniffed at, particularly in a time when there's a cost of living crisis.
I mean, if you did 2 hours a day every day for a week, so 14 times 5, 70 quid for having it all off for a couple of hours. I mean, 5 till 7 is a difficult time to live without electricity in the UK at the moment, because this time of year, because you'd be sitting in darkness. I mean, you really would be much better off just going out somewhere. 5 to 7 o'clock every day, you know. In the summer, it's not so bad, but it's that 5 to 7/6 to 8 period that there's the peak demand for cooking, of course. And a lot of people cook with electricity in the UK, including me, unfortunately. I say unfortunately because it takes a full 7 or 8 minutes for a electric hob to heat up, which is extremely frustrating. If you cook on gas, you know, you can fry an egg in seconds. Hence the popular expression, now we're cooking on gas.
Absolutely.
Because it implies instant progress. So, of course, we've got that bizarre suggestion that gas cookers be banned in the United States. I haven't heard that on this side of the pond. I don't know if you know anything about that. But go on.
No, I was going to say, I actually had heard that. I'm almost pretty sure, and I could be mistaken, I'm going to have to go and check now, that I believe that actually was Boris Johnson, and relatively recently, was talking about perhaps that is something that the councils can do to reduce the requirement of energy in people's houses, is to actually get rid of the gas system in the social housing.
He wants to go to the heat exchange, and yeah, he wants the heat pumps, all that. I've no idea how they work or whatever, but gas central heating is still, I believe, just about the most efficient and cheapest. Though, of course, while the price of wholesale gas, which skyrocketed in the autumn, has collapsed, we have yet to see any meaningful reduction in bills in the UK, with the so-called gas regulator, Ofgem, I think it is, saying that they may be reduced in April, which doesn't do people much good at this time of year, and allows the gas supply companies to profiteer off customers at the moment. I've got a chum who lives in a relatively modern three/four bedroom house down in Somerset, and to have the central heating and hot water on for a couple of hours in the morning and then a few hours in the evening is costing his family £1,000 a month.
Oh, wow. That's crazy. I was listening to
obviously, that, I mean, you don't need it quite so much in the summer, but that's £12,000 a year, which out of earned income means you've got to earn about 40%. You've got to earn £17,000 or £18,000 a year just to heat your home before you've had a cup of tea or bought a loaf of bread, which is just absolutely off the charts and about 10 times what people were paying even relatively recently. I've got a solution for it. It's very simple. I don't know if you agree with me, Christian, but on this particular issue, I'm an old school lefty. Renationalization immediately. The British people around the world, sometimes at the behest of the International Monetary Fund, other times slavishly following idiotic neoliberal policies, people around the world have been swindled out of their national assets. And the swindle goes on with price gouging and profiteering by energy companies. Things like gas are, you know, ultimately, this is my point philosophically, they belong to all of us. And the job of the supplier is simply to supply at the lowest possible price that covers the cost of maintenance and exploration. That's it. That's it.
It is a, I mean, to come in on that, I mean, you think about in the UK how much has been, you know, sold from the national control, as it were, away from government. I think maybe the government just didn't want the hassle of maintaining it and controlling it and looking after it anymore. We look at the rail, Royal Mail, you have all the water services, they all went into private hands, effectively. And I do wonder how much it would actually cost to put it back into, you know, back into government control. And I think that cost
into public ownership. We like to call it public ownership, Christian. Well, but, you know, how much does it cost to the Treasury? How long is a piece of string? And it all depends if, you know, how you want to do it. But how much is it costing to consumers to pay these ridiculous bills? I pay EDF, Electricité de France. The gas, for example, was sold off by Margaret Thatcher in the late 1980s. It was one of the, I think it was the second after telecom. The first big privatization in the UK was part of the post office, prior to about 1978, I'll have to look that up. The post office in the UK controlled both the mail and the telephone system. Both came under the aegis of the post office, believe it or not.
Yes, that's right.
History now.
Yes.
And then they were split up in the sort of late 60s, early 1970s. And subsequent to that, realizing that British Telecom, as it became, was an extremely valuable asset for purely ideological reasons, though it was argued at the time that it was more efficient if these things were in private hands, because people working for the government, it was suggested, were inherently lazy and had no incentive to provide a better service at a better price or anything, because that was sort of the Soviet model and they were feather-bedded. So even though it was still at that time a monopoly, British Telecom was sold off in an ad campaign, which I think I seem to remember featured Maureen Lipman and Bernard Breslau. Of course, you know, billions were raised for the Treasury and everybody said, oh, isn't this a marvel? Thatcherism. You know, a new form of capitalism, privatization. And subsequent to that, British Gas was sold off. Now, British Gas is even more of a natural monopoly than the telephone system. A large gas reserves had just been discovered in the North Sea at this point. But we were told by the government of the day that this would, selling off British Gas would create a stakeholder economy where everybody, you see, I mean, everybody would have a chance to own shares in British Gas, and this was wonderful. You know, you could profit from British Gas. Well, of course, obviously that overlooks the fact that in public ownership, everybody owns it anyway. So however many people bought shares in British Gas, it was always going to be less than the 100% constituency of the UK that owned it when nationalised.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You know, nevertheless, this nonsense appeared to hold some sort of sway. In a campaign that became very popular, very, very heavily advertised on British television at the time, with the catchphrase, "Tell Sid," that was it. Tell Sid that he's got until 31st of October or something to register his interest in buying shares in British Gas. So all sorts of scenarios were depicted in these television commercials of how to tell Sid. You know, Sid, who Sid was never made clear, but anyway.
I'm assuming that's one of the, once again, stakeholders.
Yeah, that's where he is now. This was, again, deemed hugely successful, even though the price of the shares immediately after privatisation shot up. More than implying, indicating that they'd been sold off too cheap, as was the case with Royal Mail. Of course, the Tories patted themselves on the back for raising a few billion for the one-off sale for the Exchequer. And what happened? Well, you know, quite a lot of the general public bought, you know, 50, 100, a few hundred shares in British Gas, only to sell them again within a few years. And of course, the vast majority of these shares now held by large institutions, pension funds, and of course, foreign-based energy companies like EDF.
Absolutely.
So, you know, the whole stakeholder economy, we were sold a pup. I knew it at the time. It was very obvious. Now we have to pay ridiculously high bills so that profits can be offshored. Whole thing is a total nonsense.
Absolutely. I'm thinking there what happened in Greece, of course, where everything was to the point it was privatized so much that when their government, when their currency failed by bankruptcy, or when it went down to such a low value, it went lower than a B, they had nothing left to sell. And then the IMF came in and was just giving them loan after loan after loan, and every country had to put into that loan just to keep their economy afloat. They were forced to join the euro and terrible amounts of... their government became fractured. I think they changed their government 5 times within 3 years. So you can see that kind of creeping in system that may well happen here. And I'm sure many other countries have done the same. They've decided to sell off their national infrastructure. And now they've just, it's legislated effectively. Oh, you guys should look after the roads. You guys should look after the telecoms. It should work. And we don't want to manage it. You guys look after it for us. And I think now we are seeing the negative side of that, how the government doesn't have any control over these things. They just sits there looking at it, like people looking at the trains, people looking at the water and the gas bill and the electric bill, going, why doesn't the government do anything? Well, actually, hands are tied in the sense that they've sold them all off, and it's just down to that company and to negotiate it, really, between its own staff.
Well, yes, and these, you know, weak so-called regulatory bodies like Ofgem, Ofcom, etc., the quangos that were sort of set up supposedly to defend consumers. In terms of electricity supply and Britain's shortfall, what do you think the long-term solution is? I used to be vehemently opposed to nuclear power, for example, but I'm starting to think it may be the only answer.
It is. I mean, I was looking at the National Grid Live earlier. So nuclear actually only supplies less than 15% of our requirement at any time. And I'm not sure how many nuclear power stations there are in the UK. Coal and gas certainly provide the greatest amount of fuel to our energy supply. Nuclear biomass, not even 5 gigawatts presently on our requirement. So how many more power stations would be required to build? And when you think about it, all them power stations, whether it be coal, gas, nuclear, effectively they're just giant kettles, you know, boiling water. Yes. And the water, the yes, steam effectively drives a turbine, and you're going, there's yes, got to be a better way of this
of generating electricity. I know it's essentially 19th century technology.
Yes, there's got to be a better way of driving a electricity dynamo. I mean, I was looking at the hydroelectric systems, and they've to my understanding, I'm sure I saw last week or the week before, although they said it was going to be off the coast of like Land's End, they were going to have like a 5 mile long kind of arm sticking out of the UK, massive hydroelectrics, and they've just scrapped the entire project.
Right.
So we won't be using that. And you think about all the waves that are around the UK, you know, people come surfing from across the world to come to Cornwall to surf. And, you know, we're not putting it to good use. And all the different currents around the UK would be ideal to drive a renewable service in that. But unfortunately, not something they want to do or have any investment in.
Well, particularly in areas, I'm thinking out loud here, like on the East Coast, where there's considerable coastal erosion. I saw a short clip of very interesting looking technology with these floats attached to a barrage, which is itself attached to a generator, which basically bounce up and down on the waves. And you get a whole row of them, hundreds of them if need be. They generate electricity. They don't appear to have any environmental impact, unlike the windmills, which are terrible bird killers. absolutely awful, yes. You know. And Solar, which... Go on.
I was going to say, I'm so glad you mentioned Bird Killers, because one of the stories I'm going to come up with next as a nice segue hits that pretty good.
Well, we'll come back to that after the break. The last one I want to mention before we go is, of course, the dreaded Solar, which, you know, we're all so excited about. And from my point of view, tell me if you think this is practical or not, the future of solar is in local personal generation. So in other words, you know, rather than the hideous solar farms, instead, you know, individual houses have their own panels, which provide 30, 40, 50, 60, or however many percent of their needs. Microgeneration, in other words, for solar, which has become extremely popular in parts of the United States, like California and that.
Oh, rightfully so. I mean, the sun they've got over there is beautiful. Over here, of course, majority of our problem is it's cloudy most of the time. It's not really ideal for us. But yeah, there was certainly a big project rolled out a few years ago where they were selling solar panels to people's roofs. And it's odd that they didn't supply that to perhaps all the social housing, because that literally is... It's owned by the government. You know, put the solar panels on
top.
It
would make sense, wouldn't it? You know.
You'd think so.
But alas. Okay, Christian. Well, I'm keen to hear what else you've got stored up. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to Basil Valentine sitting in for Patrick Henningsen this afternoon on today's News Talk TNT. Don't go away. We'll see you right after the break.
UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson's dad, Stanley, wants a climate lockdown of flying.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
Environmental activist Stanley Johnson, the father of former UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, had this to say about meeting our climate goals.
So it actually means that countries need to divvy up this carbon budget between them. And then they need to divvy up the sectors. And then they need to have the measures which deal sector by sector with getting the... And if that means actually some of us are told, well, you can't go on a plane, that's fine. That's part of the national plan.
There you have it, saying the quiet part out loud. You won't be able to fly to meet net zero goals, depending on what sector you're in. Sounds a little East German, doesn't it? You were warned about coming climate lockdowns, restrictions on driving, on travel, on free speech, on energy, on agriculture, on meat eating. You are being forced to save the planet, whether you want to or not. This is Mark Morano for the Morano Minute on TNT Radio.
You have the right to know. The right to know about culture. The right to know about the economy. The right to know about technology and to know about sports. You have the right to know about education and politics and the weather. You have the right to know what's happening abroad and in your backyard. But above all else, you have the right to know that this right is under attack, and we must work to protect it. Because in order to be free, we must be informed. Understand the threats. ProtectPressFreedom.org.
You're with Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Good afternoon, everyone in Europe. Good morning to the United States, and a very, very early good morning to everyone down there in Australia and New Zealand and anywhere else where you are in the world listening to today's News Talk. As you may or may not be able to tell, I'm not Patrick Henningsen. I'm Basil Valentine, sitting in for Patrick Henningsen on this lovely cold January afternoon. And I'm pleased to say we've been warmed up by the wisdom and dulcet tones of Christian James. Good afternoon again, Christian.
Hi, good afternoon again. So, what should we kick in? Should we kick this off then? I guess we've got about 20 minutes left to go. So,
keep going. The floor is yours.
I've been following Davos, of course, and the kind of the things that they've been talking about this past week, as I'm sure many of us have. So, one of the things that really took my attention, and it really rolls into that advert we just heard regarding Boris Johnson's dad talking about potentially, you know, if you've made purchases, the restrictions coming into place, no flying could potentially be on the cards for many people. So one of the things that's come out of this is a company called Doconomy. So D-O-C-O-N-O-M-Y. Really interesting to go check out their website. They launched a credit card a couple of years ago, and it is enforced and controlled by the World Economic Forum. And they're having a new connection with MasterCard. And part of this really is to monitor your carbon footprint of customers.
Oh God.
The idea is that of course it all. Oh yes, this is where we come in. So the primary driver of this card is what they are calling their transaction impact calculator. Now, I've been on their website and I've had a look at what that means and how it comes from. So every purchase you make as an individual using said card will have an environmental tally driven by this impact calculator. So whether you buy a pack of crisps, whether you buy some grapes, or whether you buy, I don't know, a car or whatever, so it will measure up the economic cost it has taken to get that product from the natural resource to your shopping basket, and now you've purchased it. And each of those things will work as a tally system of points, and when you reach any of those thresholds, you will be also charged, or your card will, you will no longer be able to make purchases. And that is being heavily forced as, very much so. This is what they are rolling forward. So if you were to roll on to Deconomy.com, I'd recommend people do. They have their transaction impact calculator. They have a lifestyle impact calculator as well, where your lifestyle will also be measured as your carbon footprint based on your lifestyle choices. So if you indeed have bought a chocolate cake and you've got that in your fridge, that will actually be counting against you. Potentially your weight, how much you are walking, how much what you're doing in your life, your business, your clients, who you work with, it'll also be challenged against you. And so this, when we talk about a social credit score, we're talking about a lifestyle credit score, a transaction, you know, credit score, all being measured in real time by what you purchase and what you do and where you go. A whole breadth of analytics of what, and that is the driving force of where they want to go next, based, and you, when you connect that into the not only just the social credit score, but your whole life, where you do, what you go, and it ties into an incredible control system of no transparency for what you do and what you purchase, and it really pushing towards the cashless and more.
No privacy for what you do and don't you. Total transparency. As Schwab himself said, you will have no privacy. You will own nothing, you know. Well, this is the, you know, this is related, obviously, to the Blair creature, the archdemon's call at Davos for some sort of vaccination. I use that term loosely, passport. And it's the neo-fascist biosecurity state that we need to reject very, very firmly at every stage. Lots of different ways to reject it, as it were. We've got to break it down and refute it line by line. For example, Blair said last week, very interesting the way he framed it. He said, you need to know about whose people's traveling. You need to know, projecting this, you know, mythos of a, you need, who needs to know, Tony? Who needs to know the vaccine, so-called vaccine status of people, you know, as they travel about the world? It's only about 150 years ago, there were no passports at all, you know, Christian. You could travel from one country another to another just absolutely free, irrespective of, you know,
yeah,
borders or anything. Likewise, with what you were referring to, we've got to push back against the whole carbon, so-called carbon footprint narrative. We are made of carbon. Carbon is, organic chemistry is essential to life. All life is based on carbon. Carbon dioxide is a key component of the mixed gases of the atmosphere. Declaring a war on carbon dioxide is like declaring a war on oxygen or nitrogen or something. It's just completely idiotic. Well, you know, rather than just sort of anger, we need to dismantle this nascent biosecurity state before it has a chance to take root. I'm pleased to say that the mood music amongst the Twitterati and the general commentariat, except of course in national security state organs like The Guardian towards Davos was generally very negative. People have had a look at the World Economic Forum. They've realized it's the public face of the Bilderberg Club of Rome oligarchy, and they don't like it. We don't want to be ruled by unelected plutocrats. Thank you very much.
Yeah, their plans are, you know, I guess for the future, they think that they know better than the rest of us. It's really intriguing also regarding that system. Like, airlines have actually signed up for this project as well. Qantas and Lufthansa have signed up for it, Ben and Jerry's. You can now offset the cost of your buying ice cream, so you can actually pay a bit more when you buy it with that particular card, which will now become MasterCard eventually. So the idea is that you are always paying that extra for being made of carbon. And I just think that the misnomer of that itself, like carbon zero, net zero, it's sort of saying, well, if you didn't exist, you have no carbon. So perhaps you shouldn't exist. And I kind of, it's a duopoly in their way of phrasing that. Well, there's too much carbon being used around here. You know, you might have to get rid of those people.
Yes, it's anti-life, as far as I'm concerned. An extremely spurious pseudoscience with these catchphrases like, as you say, net zero, which are, you know, we're all supposed to get sort of terribly excited about, and which become, as was the case with aspects of the events of the last few years and various other historic events I could refer to, they become articles of faith. These things become enshrined with a religiosity which cannot be challenged by heretics like myself, the true believers. Net zero, this is sacrosanct. If you do not believe in net zero, if you do not make net zero your goal, then you are some kind of, you know, denier. This is one of the favorite, frankly, you know, though I don't like the term, hate speech terms for demonizing and othering people who have a different point of view. And so it goes on. And, you know, rather than the true scientific method, which is endless challenge and research in the light of further information, instead we get these religious articles of faith, you know, CO2 bad, net zero good, carbon footprint bad, you know, repeated like mantras.
You're right. We saw that throughout the course of the pandemic. There was particular mantras that came up, that whole that religious order to things. You know, whether you go into a building and you had to wash your hands in the holy water, you had to put on your face mask as a kind of holy dress. It really was watching a religion form, and it took on some quite neo-Puritan elements to a point of where it became a religion, and now you see that wider faith growing with their greater control methods that they are bringing in, and you see what was planned and what is being expanded upon.
Yes, and of course, what's driving? Go on.
I was just gonna agree with you. It is such a control, top-down control, because that's the way that, say, certain faiths have controlled their populations, you know, for centuries. You give them a set of rules and you give them a set of laws, and then you limit them to what they are, while you, being the people who know, say, those who spoke Latin, could run away with the gold.
Yes, I mean, it's a simple fact of human nature and the psyche that some people like being controlled. They don't want to have to make difficult decisions. They like being told what to do. Simple as that. They'd much rather somebody else took all the responsibility and they just, you know, followed orders like an automaton. I mean, both men and women, all ages, there's a very sizable chunk of the population. This is arguably more prevalent among older people, for whom deference, the whole sense of deference to authority is greater, but it's also just a particular personality psychological trait in people of all ages that some whether it's by their partner, by someone at work, or by government. They just want to be told what to do. It's as simple as that.
Well, I do think that we are bombarded on a day-to-day basis by the largest volume of information that a human has ever had to take on board. Just looking at the internet. And so I do think that people are overwhelmed by information that they cannot process because there's so much of it. And I think that's what, you know, potentially the algorithms we speak quite negatively about are helping people because they get channeled information to that individual. Of course, they've been co-opted for various reasons. But I guess that's why people, instead of looking at the news every day or picking up a newspaper, they'll just look at their social media scrolling feed, whether that be Twitter or Facebook or whatever, just because it's simplified. It's just like, there's just too much to look at. I don't want it that much. It's scary. Just give me my narrow view and keep me safe. Don't let nothing come to my door. Let me go to work. Tell me what to do. And I'm going to keep my head down. And I think that's what people want to have happen.
Yeah, you're right. I was saying to somebody the other day that the internet and social media have replaced, for me, the newspaper. I no longer buy newspapers. Obviously, there's no point, unless perhaps going on a long train journey, you know,
of course, tomorrow.
Might get a newspaper for the train.
Where are you going tomorrow?
I'm going to Derbyshire. In fact, you know, thanks for reminding anyone in the UK, there's an event on in Kegworth in Derbyshire, the Comedy Podcast Live at the Kegworth Hotel and Conference Centre. With Patrick will be there actually, and all sorts of other luminaries and stars of the independent media scene, including Right Said Fred, Gareth Icke, Phil Zimmerman, Andrew Lawrence, and many more. And that's tomorrow night. I think tickets are still available. That's tomorrow night, all day Saturday and Sunday morning up there in sunny Derbyshire. So I don't know if we'll see you there, Christian.
Yeah, Patrick did send me an invite earlier today. So I'm free tomorrow afternoon. I might trek over for a few hours and come and say hello and come to meet some interesting people. I'm sure there's lots to be.
Yeah, so great. Yeah, I believe he said you're in Nottingham.
Yes, so I'm literally about 17 miles away. So I'm going to hop on a train.
Oh, well, absolutely no excuse. Well, I look forward to meeting you then. In the meantime, back to the main event. What drives and reinforces this this fear and this obedience all the time is you said we're in an age where people are bombarded with more information than they've ever had before. But unfortunately, if you do nothing but absorb the lying corporate media, all bar the football results and the weather is propaganda.
I think nowadays we're just... I think we're educated to just consume content as well. Everything's manufactured for us to keep it simple. It's you look at, say, how, you know, social media platforms in certainly the last couple of years, something like TikTok, something like YouTube Shorts, they're simpler. The message is no longer information. It's just, you know, it's instant now. And I think that's how we've re-educated ourselves, that you need instant gratification, instant content, and then you flash in onto the next thing. But there's nothing is being absorbed. There's no knowledge coming through at all.
No, that's right. It is instant gratification. The attention spans have shrunk down to a few minutes or even seconds, you know. But the, you know, the reason why we're in such a mess with Ukraine, for example, why there aren't 2 million people on the streets of London on Saturday afternoon, as there were when Blair launched the illegal war against Iraq, is that the anti-Russian propaganda has been so successful.
I was going to say, well, I'm trying to think of when that actually began, but I guess that was reinforced with the Donald Trump initiation coming into presidency, and we saw that whole anti-Russian propaganda that kicked off there, which was legally proven to be false information, but that has never dissipated since. You know, that was the Russia is our intense boogeyman that we need to keep over there, and It's like a whole new Cold War has begun, a whole full spectrum warfare has begun. And we are now seeing, you know, it's technically we're boots on the ground. NATO is obviously knee deep into Ukraine now, selling them hardware that requires NATO rounds. You know, NATO is there, and that means we're there.
Yeah, we, Patrick and I, go a long way back. The when England didn't get the World Cup, and it went to Russia and then Qatar. We think the in the UK the anti-Russian stuff started then, if not before. You know, it's been going for a long time. Do you want to join us again after the top of the hour, Christian?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm free and available, so sure.
I'm sure you've got more to talk about.
Always.
Great. This is Basil Valentine sitting in for Patrick Henningsen. Don't go away. We'll be back after these news headlines.